Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Kay Patuk, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula, and hello to you, the listener.
Hello, Kay, and hello to you, the listener. It looks as if we have a full program today, Kay. You did a lot of work.
This year, the Islamic month of fasting begins on the evening of June the 17th. So it really begins on June the 18th. So we'll be talking about Ramadan to two members of the mosque here in Ames, which is also known as the Dar al-Aqwam Islamic Center. They'll be telling us about the meaning of Ramadan and also about the practicalities of fasting and about the feasting and the festival of Eid al-Fitr, which takes place at the end of Ramadan.
We'll also dig into our archives for some history about the building of the mosque. And for that, we'll hear part of an interview that Local Talk reporter Susan Franson did on this topic with the former city council member, Raed Mahaney.
We'll also be hearing an interview by Greta Anderson about learning Arabic at Ames High School. Six graduating seniors have been studying Arabic for 4 years, and Greta spoke with one of them, Anya Chamberlain, and also her teacher, Daniel Klass. Let's hear that interview now.
Okay.
I want to say shukran to everyone I see instead of thank you, you know, if they hold the door open for me. Or it's really funny, actually. After school got out, I was really sad not to be speaking Arabic every day, and I just had this intense desire to say marhaban kayfa hal, which means like hello / welcome, how are you, to everyone that walked in the room where I was. It just kind of makes me happy to speak in Arabic.
That's the voice of Anya Chamberlain, one of six seniors who graduated from Ames High School this year with 4 years of Arabic language training under their belts. Theirs was the first class to have Arabic offered as a language, and for now, it is the last. Even as they progressed through second, third, and fourth year Arabic, incoming freshmen did not have the opportunity to take Arabic 1. Yet taking this language, the fourth most commonly spoken in the world, definitely had an impact on those in the class of 2015 who chose to continue it through the 4 years.
All but actually one of the seniors that graduated from Arabic is going to be majoring in it next year, and the one that isn't, he really wishes he could. So I think all of us really want to continue this. I know one of my friends, she wants to study international relations, and she is going to be majoring in Arabic at Drake. And then another one of my classmates, she wants to do public health, and she is also going to be majoring in Arabic. And another boy who's going to University of Iowa, he'll be majoring in Arabic. So the majority of students that have taken it, I think, have gotten a lot from it.
I interviewed these students' teacher, Daniel Klass, who also teaches French and social studies at Ames High. We'll spend the rest of the segment switching back and forth between Anya's and Mr. Klass's perspectives.
This would have been in the 2010. We had a new principal, and he wanted to try some new things, and he had heard that I speak Arabic and had been trying to introduce it into the school for a bit. And he asked me if he wanted to give it a shot and actually offer it as a class, and if I could get certified, endorsed with the state of Iowa, and I said I could, and that's what we did, and our first class was Arabic 1 in fall of 2011. When we first started the class, we had, I think, 65 students sign up, and then eventually, like all language classes, not everyone sticks with it for 4 years, but the group that I had that just graduated, they had me for 4 years, and it was quite a learning experience for both of us, actually, for them and for me. And last year, we took a class trip to Oman in the Arabian Gulf. And we were there for 2 weeks, and we partnered with an organization there that normally does language instruction and cultural excursions for university students, mostly American. And Ames High School was the first high school to actually use them, and it was wonderful. And we made a good impression on them, and they made a very positive impression on us. So that was spring break of last year.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, it was.
And tell me more about the learning experience, this kind of reciprocal learning experience.
It was my first time teaching at a high school level Arabic, And so it was exciting and quite gratifying to see the students grow into the language, to use it in a kind of organic way, to want to use it, to want to speak it. Also, they were a very intellectually stimulating group, very bright and inquisitive, and so we were kind of fellow travelers, I'd like to think, in that way. I saw, in some ways, some of myself in them the same way that I started long ago.
And it must have also been kind of unique to stick with the same students for 4 years in a row.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it because things are quite segmented in high school, and you get to know some of the students here and there, but there is just this very rigid bell schedule, and there's a lot of different classes at Ames High School, and it's, you know, somewhat of a large high school, I suppose, about 1,400 students. And so to get to know the same group for a while was very good because in the language, learning the language, that's very important, I think, to have that emotional connection with hopefully the teacher and the material, because it's a different kind of learning subject than something that might be a little more external to the person, like history or chemistry, which are interesting subjects. But a language, it's very bodily, as you know, and it's part of your anatomy. It's part of your thought processes, and so it just functions at a deeper level. And so to have the same group of students for that whole time working with a subject that is so profound, I think, and able to quite literally shift neurons around, as we know about where language lives in the brain and everything, I found very exciting and very gratifying.
Sometimes we had conversations about what we liked so much about it. I think something that makes it very satisfying to learn is that it's both a mathematical language, so there's a lot of rhythm and pattern to it, and it's musical, also because of the rhythm and the way it sounds to the ear. So it's mathematically satisfying and intellectually satisfying, but it's also deeply emotionally satisfying because of the connection between all of the words and the root system with how the whole language is set up. The root system is truly fascinating. Almost every word in the language is based on a three-letter root. So there are 10 different patterns you can plug in a three-letter root into, and the most basic one is usually just you doing something like, okay, the root, that means to cut. The first root means literally just to, like, chop a vegetable or something. And then when you plug the root into the 10th pattern, it has to do with an emotional breakup or something like that. And so it just gets more sophisticated, and I think, and a deeper meaning. It's a longer word. So there are all these connections you can, based on the length of a word, you can pretty much understand more how complex an idea will be. So it's really, really different than English.
Huh. And you also said it was mathematical, and that's not a word that, a descriptor that people usually use for a language. Can you put into words how that works?
Mm-hmm. So the fact that there are roots with three letters that every word can be paired down to is very similar to algebra. And actually, algebra was invented, or maybe because they discovered, I'm not sure, in the Middle East. The root that means algebra is al-jabr, and I think it actually means to pare something down to just to the root of what it means. So like in algebra, you get rid of all the extra stuff to really find what x equals, you know. And so in Arabic, it's very similar because you can take away all of the extra stuff that conjugates the word and changes its meaning to get down to the root of it.
On a personal level, it was in some ways the easiest work I've done, in the sense that it's work that I had been wanting to do for a long time. And so I'm grateful that I was able to kind of match that that desire that I had with this kind of work, you know. So it always was just very joyful, really, to do this, you know, to even lesson plan for it and to craft what we were going to do. It was difficult, too, in the sense that it's a bit of a whiplash, you know, to teach the psychology and then and then teach Arabic. In fact, 2 years ago, I had Arabic class in between some French sections. That is, I had a French 1, and then I had Arabic 2, and then I had another French class after that. And I swear, that was the hardest thing I've ever done, because my brain couldn't shift back again. And I would, in my French class, I would open my mouth and Arabic would fly out, which I was sort of embarrassing.
Can you give me an example of an expression in Arabic that is illustrative of a different mindset that brings that cultural aspect of language to the fore?
Sure. Well, the one that many people might know is to say hello, which in the formal usage would be salamu alaikum, which literally means peace upon you. Kum is a plural, so if we're to put it in southern United States parlance, it'd be like peace y'all or something like that. And the response is back to the person to say, well, alaikum assalam, well, peace to you. And then the send-off that we often use in a formal Arabic would be ma salama, which means with peace you go, you know, which is kind of a nice thought.
Could you comment? I'm sure your class had some discussions about this concept of peace and how central it is to the language,
yeah,
and yet how troubled the areas that speak this language are.
Yeah. That was always the unspoken, sometimes elephant in the room, that what we know about the Middle East is purely political, so many of us, because that's the news we get. And that matters, no question about it. But there's other things that go on in a pretty big region with a lot of people that I sometimes call it the boring Middle East that we don't hear about, you know, people just kind of living their lives and not involved in any sort of uprising against their government. And so there was a tension because, on the one hand, I didn't want to ignore some of the happenings, especially when we started, the Arab Spring was kicking off, and that was relevant, that was important. On the other hand, it was not a class on Middle East politics or international relations or comparative government, so I didn't want to get sucked into that direction. You know, I wanted to talk about literature, I want to talk about arts, about poetry, and yes, also politics. So I built in some lesson plans dealing with the Arab Spring, and we saw some films on that. But I wanted the students to have a broader appreciation of a very, very old and complex region, of which Arabic is just one part of it. I mean, there's other languages and peoples there, too, in the Middle East.
So I work at Cook's Emporium, and last year when I was working, there was a woman that came to a cooking demo, and she was visiting from Kuwait because her son went to Iowa State. And she brought coffee with cardamom in it and dates to share with everybody. And I just said something to her in Arabic because I could hear that she was speaking it with her husband. And after just talking with her for about 10 minutes, she invited me to come to her son's apartment and cook Kuwaiti food with her. And she would teach me Arabic words. So I just spent an afternoon with her cooking.
The other thing when it comes to the arts that we talked about, in some ways even more so than poetry, was the emphasis on calligraphy and the presentation of the script, of any Arabic script, and how that impacts art and architecture. There's this this creative energy that goes into design and calligraphy and geometry, which you can see if you go to a lot of the famous mosques around the world and just start looking at doorways and such. So we spent a lot of time on that also. And that's something we also saw in Oman.
So did you do calligraphy in class?
A little bit. It's quite hard to do well. It's a pretty rigorous art form, but we did some, yeah. You also need, if you're going to do it right, you need the right equipment.
And that can be expensive stuff.
Yeah, it's pricey. You need it has to have the right slant and the right kind of ink and the right kind of paper. Mm-hmm. But I love it. In fact, I think one day when I'm, a grumpy old man, that'll be ways to pass my time, I think, is to do that on my own, because I'm really interested in the art of the lettering. But I think I'll need some, like, real training on that.
Anya Chamberlain is not sure what, besides Arabic, will be her focus at college. Maybe environmental policy, but she does know she will be participating in the Arabic language conversation group that Grinnell College has. As for the future of Arabic language at Ames High School, here's Daniel Klass.
Next year, we're not going to have Arabic, but I'm told that after that, there's a possibility that it'll come back. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to start it again in fall of 2016. It's a testimony, I think, to the community of Ames that this was offered, and it was, accepted, and I never got any friction from anyone in the community, and I really do appreciate that.
Thank you so much for speaking with me, Daniel Klass.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you very much.
Ma'a salama.
Ma'a salama.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just been listening to an interview about studying Arabic at Ames High School. These graduating seniors obviously enjoyed studying Arabic so much. The interview included Anya Chamberlain, an Ames High student who studied Arabic, and her teacher, Daniel Klass. The segment was produced by KHOI reporter Greta Anderson.
We'll be hearing a little bit more about studying Arabic because it's one of the subjects taught at the Islamic school at the Ames Mosque, and I interviewed the principal of the Islamic school. But first, let's hear a bit about the history of building the mosque.
The mosque, Darul Aqwam Islamic Center, is built on a pretty large plot of land on Iowa Avenue in Ames, which is reporter Susan Franson's neighborhood, or was her neighborhood.
Oh, right, because she's going to move soon. Yeah.
Literally moving. So Susan took an interest in the mosque from the beginning. Partly because of that early interest, we were able to access this interview from our archives to use for this program. In it, Susan interviews Raed Mahini, a former city councilman and also the former head of the Planning and Zoning Commission here in Ames. There was some resistance in the neighborhood to the mosque being built. At the beginning of this segment, Raed is discussing the campaign that was launched by some people in the neighborhood when the mosque was being planned. This is some of his description.
That issue made me so proud of the city because there was a campaign, and it was an ugly campaign at that time. There's no need to mention names. I was involved with it right from the beginning. At that time, I was serving on the Planning and Zoning Commission. And you know, the Muslim community in Ames had a mosque two streets down. It's a house, a large house. They wanted to, you know, build a mosque. And they looked all over town till they found this lot, which is a large lot. I think it was one acre. Before they even made a bid on it, a lawyer contacted me, which was asked by some of the neighbors, not all the neighbors, by some of the neighbors. And I arranged a meeting for them in City Hall, the neighbors, the people from the mosque, plus Brian O'Connell, who was the director of planning. No one showed up from the neighborhood. The lawyer showed up, but no one from the neighborhood showed up. And it passed. It went through the Zoning Board of Adjustments. It went through Planning and Zoning. And it ended up in the city council. And I have that meeting, as a matter of fact, taped. My son at that time, who was 10 years old at that time, taped it. And I did not participate in the discussion whatsoever. I excused myself and I sat with the people and they debated it. Passed unanimously by city council. Then they sued the city and the mosque. It took almost a year. They delayed the project almost a year and a half. I have the court statement on it. It was devastating to them. And the judge ruled that the city was following all the rules and regulations, and there's nothing. They tried to take it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused it. The mosque got built. It was done in February 2002, I think. We had an open house. And this is after 9/11. Close to 1,500 people came to the open house. Some of the neighbors who sued were the one who also came. And one of them, who was very active, especially writing letters to the editors, sent a bouquet of roses. I bet you he paid close to $200, $300 for it. Because when they saw the building, you know, and they realized that this was a nice addition to the neighborhood. We never had any trouble in that neighborhood since the mosque started. I think it's a beautiful building, and parking is an issue once a week for about 1 hour. And this is when people are at work. They are not in the neighborhood.
Because your services are conveniently in the afternoon, Friday afternoon.
That's right. It was an episode. You know, you have to go through whatever it takes. But here it is now.
That's a glimpse of the history of the mosque from an interview that Susan Franzen had with a former member of the Planning and Zoning Commission, Riyad Mahaini, talking about the opposition to the building of the mosque. Now, here are some comments about the same issue from a present-day board member at the mosque, Salahuddin Syed.
They started building it, and there were a lot of objections by the neighbors. But the good news is, after we built, we have been very happy with our neighbors, and they haven't, as far as I know, have no issues with how we do our business in the mm-hmm. mosque. We are very quiet. We don't have any firecrackers outside anytime. Even actually, by our Islamic religion, we cannot disturb our neighbors also.
So that was one of the things they were afraid of, that there'd be firecrackers going off.
Yeah, I don't know how they come up with that.
Well, I guess sometimes you see movies of India and you see firecrackers going off, but I think that's Hindus that are doing that.
Yeah, anyway. That's a Diwali festival that happens in Hindus.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Kay Patek, one of your hosts, together with my co-host Ursula Rudenberg. We've been hearing about the building of the mosque. Now let's learn more about Islam and the month of fasting, or Ramadan, that's coming up soon. And we'll hear an interview I had with Salahuddin Syed, or Sal, who's a member of the congregation at that mosque and also on the board of directors. Sal did say he is not a scholar of Islam. He is speaking more as a private individual and a practitioner of the faith and a member of the mosque. But what, in your opinion, is the most important thing that non-Muslims should understand about Islam?
Basically, I would like my fellow citizens to know that Islam is a basic continuation of the same message that was revealed by our Creator God to all the prophets like Abraham, David, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them all. People have to know that we have more commonalities with the people of the faith like Jews and Christians than any other faiths. Having said that, people have to understand the followers of any particular religion based upon their own understanding and their own shortcomings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, we all make our own interpretation. And I believe there is an interfaith council in Ames that talks about the connections between the Abrahamic faiths.
Yes, we as a group of maybe 8 to 10 peoples representing different faiths, like the Jewish synagogue here in Ames, the Catholic St. Cecilia's Church, and the Islamic Center of Ames, also called as Darul Arqam. We have regular events where we meet and discuss and eat together so that we exchange our beliefs and what our social issues are in the community.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the more interesting discussions you've had in that group about the differences and the similarities?
We started first session with a prescribed book by an organization called as ISNA. Scholars of Islam and Jewish scholars have written a book called as Sons of Abraham, because we believe that we are all descendants of Abraham, the prophet of God. So we started with that. We Muslims stress that God sent the same message to all the prophets, and over the period of time, people have changed the message. And we were trying to figure out why that change happened.
And one example of that would be the business with Ishmael and Isaac.
Yeah, the story that we have differences of opinion comes from the biblical and Quranic narrative of who Abraham was.
Or who his eldest son was.
Eldest son was, and who is the one who took to be sacrificed.
Right. Yes, according to the Old Testament, it was Isaac, but according to the Quran, it's Ishmael.
Ishmael, yes.
Yeah. But it's basic same story.
But again, the moral of the story is, can human beings sacrifice for the command of God? That was the moral of the story, not about who is the first or second.
Mm-hmm, sure.
That actually comes very close to what Ramadan is actually about. Ramadan is basically, can you sacrifice your hunger and thirst just because God commanded you to do that?
So what is the origin of Ramadan?
Ramadan is basically a ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So in this month, it is said that in the Quran says that God revealed the Quran, the scripture for humanity, in this particular month.
Okay, so that's what it commemorates. It commemorates the revelation.
The revelation of the Quran.
Uh-huh.
And also the completion of the Quran, because Quran was revealed, started to be revealed in Ramadan, and it was completed in the month of Ramadan.
Okay.
Over the period of 23 years. And then the whole thing was completed in the month of Ramadan.
Okay. So, and this...
So, this Quran also gives as a constitution for Muslims how you should lead your life.
So, the origin is that it was the month during which the Quran was revealed, or the revelation began, and when it was finished.
Yes.
And what happens during Ramadan is that you... What happens?
So according to the commands of God, as soon as you see the crescent of the moon of the month of Ramadan, you start fasting. That means you abstain from drinking and eating from dawn to dusk. So what is the purpose of this? Why are we being restrained from the things that are already allowed? Ramadan is one time where you can show your devotion to God without showing it to anybody.
Right.
Only God knows what you have eaten, what you haven't eaten.
Right, it's so personal. Yeah.
So it's kind of a very personal control of your own impulses, mm-hmm. so that you can become closer to God. That's what God says. I wanted human beings to fast so that they can become closer to me. That means whenever I am not eating, I'm consciously knowing that I'm thirsty or I'm hungry, but I'm not going to eat because I have made this contract with God that I will not eat just because you said so. Not because my parents said so, my culture said so, or my country said so. It's because I have an obligation towards God. And that makes me a better human being.
Now, you said it begins with a new moon, so it's a movable feast like Easter. Or,
yes.
And I believe this year it begins, what, on the 18th of June, is it?
Yes, it begins on the 18th of June, and it ends with the next month of the Islamic mm-hmm. calendar, end of the Ramadan month.
So the fasting during the month of Ramadan for people who aren't sick or elderly or children,
mm-hmm.
this is one of the requirements.
It is a compulsory requirement, yes.
One of the five mm-hmm. pillars of Islam.
Yes.
Could you tell us about the other pillars of Islam? These are the five things that all good Muslims should observe.
Any practicing Muslim should be first attesting to the faith, saying that there's only one creator we call Allah to be worshipped to, and saying that Prophet Muhammad is the last prophet of God.
So that's the first
that's
thing.
It's the
just
first creed,
the creed
of Islam.
Yeah.
And everything
there's one God and Muhammad is his prophet. Yeah.
And everything that you follow after that should be based upon these foundations. For example, once you say those things, you have to pray five times a day at a specific time.
So that's the second requirement.
That's the second pillar.
Now that brings praying five times a day. In some countries where Islam is pretty widespread, you have a call to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you hear from the mosques, you hear the muezzin calling out for people to pray. And that doesn't happen at this mosque. Why is that?
It doesn't happen. The way we have designed the Islamic Center in Ames is we don't have a minaret where traditionally you put a loudspeaker there or physically a person climbs up the minaret and mm-hmm. calls the prayer so that people in the neighborhood can be reminded of what is more important in life.
Mm-hmm.
And these prayers are not long prayers. They are like 5 to 10 minutes prayers. So people can come, wash off, pray, and then go back to their routine. In Ames or in most of the parts of the America, we cannot because many city ordinances don't allow us to have noise outside our buildings.
No, the loudspeakers.
Loudspeakers.
Yeah. Actually, we've got a loudspeaker outside our radio station here, but it's pretty quiet. You have to be right outside the door before mm-hmm. you hear it. Okay, so the creed is the first thing. Fasting during Ramadan, praying five times a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's three. What are the other two?
The fourth is called as zakat, which is you give a charity of at least 2.5% of your savings to the needy people. It starts usually with the most closest of the relatives that are most needy, and then it goes beyond that. So it says if you cannot even sustain yourself, you don't have to give charity. You have to have savings first to give charity.
Okay. And the fifth one?
The fifth one is if you are financially and physically able to go to Hajj once in a lifetime.
Hajj is the pilgrimage
Hajj
to Mecca.
Hajj is a pilgrimage that a Muslim performs by going to Mecca.
Have you been on the pilgrimage?
Yes.
You have?
I was very fortunate to be.
Oh, yes. When was that?
I went in 2008.
Uh-huh. What was it like?
It was very exciting. I never have seen such... I think when we went, there were 2.5 or 3 million people mm-hmm. in a small city, and everybody was devoted to one and one thing only, mm-hmm. to submit to their creator. So imagine the whole world coming to one place, because you can see country people from all nations of the world, all different colors, sizes. Mm-hmm. They all come and worship one God in one language, in one direction. And they're all doing rituals in 4 or 5 days, and they're all moving in the same streamline. You can see people moving in one direction, mm-hmm. and they're all moving in one direction next day. It's amazing to see millions of people worshipping one God in one direction and not knowing one language that is common.
Yeah.
It's a,
well, that's
it's
quite an
feat.
Organizational feat.
It is a huge feat, and they do it very well. Uh-huh. They do it perfectly well.
Now, getting back to the fast of Ramadan, how does your own family observe Ramadan? And when I say your own family, I mean your family now. And is it different from the way you practiced when you were growing up?
Are you talking about the fasting part or the Eid part?
Well, both.
You know, local cultural differences and where your parents are from, where you're raised, has a lot of differences. And mm-hmm. people, how they perform their fasting or how they break their fast and how they do their Eid al-Fitr. We call the end of the month of Ramadan is called Eid al-Fitr, the festival. For example, I like to break fast certain way because I grew up in Bangalore, South India. And my wife grew up in Texas. So we have some mixture of things that happen in our house because we have two different way we were raised. She being Texan, she has her own way of doing things, and me being South Indian, we kind of merge together.
Okay.
Because the kids are American, so we have to... You know, Americans like beef.
Sure.
So we like chicken and goat. Uh-huh. So, you know, the kids like beef too, so it goes more to her side because, you know... Uh-huh. So depending upon, because we don't eat pork, it becomes easy. So we have one faith, so we don't eat pork. So other than that, most of the times the kids win the battle. They decide what we eat. Uh-huh. festival.
I understand the festival at the end of Ramadan. There's mm-hmm. a big feast. Mm-hmm. I've heard it's like Christmas. I mean, in its importance. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I wanted to ask you about when you eat at the end of the day. Is that sort of a big celebration too, because you've been fasting all day and at last you're eating, or is that just something simple? Or
again, depends upon your own appetites and mm-hmm. your culture. I used to eat a lot when I was young. Now I don't. People tend to overeat in Ramadan, sadly.
Yeah, I've heard that people often gain weight during Ramadan.
Yeah, and that's the sad part about Ramadan, is basically to control your own desires, and people have lost that focus.
And now, how about the celebration at the end of Ramadan, Eid al?
Depending on the temperature and the weather in Ames, we have done it in parks, like some city parks, or we have done it within the mosque. Usually we get catered food from some outside agencies that will supply cooked food. And we have some fun stuff for kids. We go bowling, we go to laser tag, things like that. Kids will go do their stuff, and men will usually sit and eat. And women will sit and eat and talk.
Uh-huh, sure.
So it's pretty much socializing, exchanging mm-hmm. gifts. We welcome visitors to the masjid, to the mosque, and if anybody wants to visit, they have to just go to the website, arqum.org.
Well, actually, if you just Google mosque in Ames, that will come up.
And then there's this the window there, you can click on that and say, I want to visit a mosque, and you are more than welcome to come and look at the mosque, learn about Muslims and Islam.
Well, I guess I should wish you a happy Ramadan.
Thank you very much. We say Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak.
Yes.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for today, together with Kay Patak, who really did the bulk of the work for today's show and in interviewing people. And since this is the month of Ramadan, we've been learning about this most important event in the Islamic calendar and about the festival of Eid al-Fitr, which comes at the end of Ramadan. Kay, I believe that in the next interview that you're providing for this show, you wanted to get the point of view of a woman in the Islamic faith.
Yes, I did. So I interviewed Nermin Sabri, who's also the principal of the Islamic school at the mosque. She explained that it's literally a Sunday school because the kids attend every Sunday for 3 hours. Sunday is really a free day for Muslims because Friday is their worship day. And as this interview begins, I'm asking Nermin about the school. Would you like to tell me about the activities at the Islamic school that you're the principal of?
We accept students like from 5 years old until, you know, maybe 15, 16, until they stop going to the Islamic school for a reason or another.
They just choose not to go anymore.
They feel like they cannot associate themselves with younger kids anymore, uh-huh. And they need something specifically for them, for youth. We teach 3 subjects. We teach the Holy Script, we teach the Quran, reading and memorization, and we teach the Arabic language, which the Quran was revealed. If they learn the Arabic, they will be able to read the Quran from the original script, mm-hmm. not a translation. Mm-hmm. And also we teach them Islamic study, and this is like the Islamic teaching, how they can conduct their lives, because we believe that Islam is a way of life. So they need to know what's the Islamic perspective of things.
Well, thank you. I was hoping to get a woman's point of view of Islam from you and also to hear what you have to say about the woman's role in Islam. But first of all, I understand you were the person that received this hate letter to the mosque in, was it March this year?
It was like in February.
Okay.
We had like a meeting, kind of learning social meeting at the mosque at this time. And we discovered this letter on one of the racks, the coat rack. The letter was attracting the attention. It was by the door. It was addressed to the Muslim community in general, mm-hmm. warning and threats and things like that.
Well, very disturbing. Yeah.
Yeah. And we had to call the police, and they came, and they took the letter, and they took the matter seriously. It was, like, under investigation for a long time, but you know, we did not hear anything, so I guess maybe they could not find any fingerprints on it or anything. The good side is we had lots of support from the community, and we didn't even expect that. We had, like, one of the members in one of the churches, you know, they draw, like, a poster to support us. And it came from, like, second, third graders.
Oh, lovely.
That was the amazing. Mm-hmm. Some people, individual people, they left flowers, cards, lots of support came on the website. It was, like, really a very good feeling to see that we are welcomed in the community. We have lots of support. And the people who did that, you know, there are individuals who are not representing,
right.
you know, the majority of the community right. here in Ames.
Yeah.
So that was very assuring. That
yes,
was very
that
nice.
Yes, it's very reassuring. Well, coming up soon is going to be Ramadan, right?
Yeah.
Starts this year on the 18th, really, of June, right?
So it's,
and it continues until the 17th?
17th of July.
July. Now, certain people are excused from this, children, the elderly, the sick, and so on, and if they're diabetic or whatnot. But everybody else fasts, and then in the evening, it's over. They break their fast, and it would be a tendency, I suppose, for the person that's cooking for the household, perhaps, to try to make up for their deprivation all day. And so I wondered if you could talk about that, the kinds of foods. Now, of course, I realize there's so many different cultures are Muslim that, you know, what people eat varies very much within the Islamic world. But for example, in your own experience when you were growing up and, you know, when you began to fast at what age, if you could talk a bit about that. And now you have a family, how you cook for them and so on. If you could talk about that, that'd be very interesting.
First, fasting is not obligatory before the age of puberty. Mm-hmm. So anything before that, it will be like kind of training. If we let some kids, you know, start to fast, so it's only training for them. So when they reach the age of puberty, they will be ready, you know, for the complete day of fasting.
So they might fast for maybe half the day or something like that?
Yeah, and it's up to every family to decide and up to, you know, up to them to decide which child, you know, can fast or not. Because some kids, you know, they have like health conditions right. and things like that. So they are not capable of fasting at a very early age. Sometimes, you know, the Ramadan come is in winter, so it's easier to fast. But when it's summer, the families has to be careful, you know, when to let their kids start to fast because it's a long day. For my own kid, the older ones, when they start to fast was like in the middle of the summer, the day was very long. So I will let them fast like 3 days a week and give them rest, you know, the rest of the week. Uh-huh. For my younger son, when he started to fast, it was in winter and sunset was around like 5 o'clock. So it was very easy for him to fast. So he didn't find any difficulty. Right. So I let him start fasting, you know, at as early as 8 years old. So it depends, you know, on the child, on the family, on the season, things like that. For food preparation, to me, it shouldn't be like a big feast or a big deal. Because, you know, when you are fasting, you feel like you're going to eat a lot after that. And, you know, you are craving different food and everything. But once, you know, you start to have like few bites, you feel full right away. Right. And, you know, you shouldn't like overwhelm yourself, you know, with food because, you know, some people suffer after that. So right. it's easier, you know, to eat like small portions, two or three times better than like having like a heavy meal.
Courses.
Exactly.
Yes.
Better than having like a big heavy meal,
right.
you know.
And a little pause between each course. Yes.
So little pause, you know, can help your digestive system digest. Mm-hmm. I avoid personally cooking certain dishes in Ramadan. I avoid like fried food, avoid like any heavy dishes because you feel like you cannot tolerate it. I try to make things that it's nutritional and simple and easy to digest.
And I was reading that it's traditional. Muhammad ate dates first when breaking his fast.
Yes. And it helps a lot because, you know, that will give your digestive system a chance to have the sugar needed.
Right,
that,
boost your blood sugar.
Yes, so it will boost your energy and you feel that now you are ready to have more food.
Mm-hmm. How about the famous celebration at the end of Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr?
Yeah.
This is, one of my students said this was like Christmas. It's a big, big, big celebration.
It is because, you know, after fasting for a month, you know, when you break your fast, you celebrate with your family, you celebrate with your neighbors, your friends, this occasion of breaking the fast. We have certain desserts that we usually make. For every culture, you know, they have their own, you know, desserts. We start our day by a prayer in the mosque. And we exchange gifts too. And, you know, the kids, they wait, you know, for this occasion. They wait, you know, for the gifts. And they like it. Especially, you know, the kids who are who were fasting in Ramadan. So they feel that it's a kind of a reward for them. Yeah, it is special because, you know, everyone were fasting, all celebrating the break of the fast. We all celebrate that we successfully continued and finished the month of Ramadan. So it is like a big celebration.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we were hoping, you know, that public school will acknowledge these celebrations so the kids feel comfortable not to go to school instead of asking permission of
right.
not going to school.
Right.
Now, you know, the Eid al-Fitr will come before school starts anyway, so we don't have a problem.
Oh, that's lucky, yes.
Yeah.
Well, how about the role of women in Islam?
The Muslim woman is like any other woman in the society. We can see them everywhere. You can see them as students. We can see them as working moms. We can see them as staying home moms. And it's up to them to choose, you know, whatever they prefer to do. There is like encouragement in the Islamic teaching to let everyone pursue education, whether for men or women. So we are all encouraged to have some education. It can differ from one person to another. That's their own choice. like in any society.
Right. Now, how about things like wearing the hijab? Is that a matter of choice, or how does that work?
It's part of the teaching of Islam. Wearing hijab is required in Islam, but of course it's a choice. Whether you want to follow the guidance of Islam or not, so it's a choice. If you choose not to, it's not like by force, or no one can force you, you know, to do it.
Do you ever get in one family, some of the daughters might choose to wear the hijab and some not? Does that ever happen?
Yeah, of course, mm-hmm. You know.
It's a certain age that one starts wearing it?
It's around the age of puberty.
Okay.
All the acts of worship are obligatory by the age of puberty, because this is what Islam considered, that this is when, like, the full personality developed at this time. Mm-hmm. For example, like my daughters, I had two daughters. I taught them the teaching of Islam, and it was, you know, the choice of each one of them when is the right time for her to wear it. So I didn't push anyone or force anyone to wear the hijab. I taught them what's right and what's wrong, and they chose, you know, the time for them. This is how it should be. If people does it in another way, so they shouldn't force anyone to do anything, including the hijab.
Yeah, actually, in Christian scriptures, you know, in the New Testament, the epistles of Paul said women should, how does it go? Women should have their head covered in church.
Yes.
Well, certainly kind of. When I was growing up, girls and women wore hats to church.
Yeah.
This was sort of required. But now nobody bothers. They don't observe that. Except, you know, if it's a wedding or something, they wear a fancy hat. But
yeah, it's always been like a symbol of modesty.
Right.
And Muslim people come from different cultures, so they have different type of clothing. So that's why there is no specific type of clothes that it's required for a Muslim to wear. A dress code, if you fulfill it in the West or the East or anywhere, if you have this criteria, so it will be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
As long, you know,
it's modest.
As long it's modest.
Now, talking of different cultures, if you look around this town, like Christian churches, there's so many different denominations, and people can pick and choose which Christian church they go to. Whereas if you're a Muslim, there's just one mosque here. So presumably the different denominations of Islam go to that one mosque.
It's kind of a different situation in Islam, because we don't have denomination. We have like different scholars that interpret the teaching of Islam in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But it will not touch the basics of the religion.
Well, people think of Sunni and Shia, I suppose, as different denominations.
It's not a different denomination. They have like certain different point of views about certain things,
mm-hmm.
but the main idea of the religion is the same.
Mm-hmm.
I saw in some countries, for example, Sunni and Shia, both of them live together for many years.
Oh.
They marry from each other. In the same house, you can see, you know, some family members are Sunni and some family members are Shia, and they can live together without any problems. But lately, it's been politicized and lots of interference from other factors.
Right. Regarding the mosque in Ames, Sunni and Shia both use that. And
yes, both of us are using the same mosque. Like if we have like five pillars of Islam, both of us, we believe in the five pillars.
Sure.
Both of us pray five times a day, and all the prayers are at the same time.
Sure. Okay. I think people are interested in the reason for I believe women and men are separated in the mosque for worship.
Yeah. It's not a separation, but we have a designated area for women,
mm-hmm.
if they chose to be separate than men. Most of the times we have like the women will have like small children with them.
Mm-hmm.
And small children, whether they are like nursing them, sometimes, you know, they are fussy, they cry, you know, they need their moms. They sometimes make more noise than on the men's side. So since the sermon or the prayer happened on the men's prayer hall, so they need like more quiet. Some women, they choose, you know, to have some privacy, so at least they are not disturbing the worshipers. But there is no prevention from women to attend the prayer or the activities in the men's prayer hall. Some women, especially now the older women like me, I don't have small children anymore, so some of us will choose, you know, to attend the sermon or the prayer in the men's prayer hall because it's quieter. There is no prevention of attending.
In the other room where women are with the children, is the sound of the sermon, does it come over the speaker system?
We have, we have speakers and we have a screen, so they still can follow the sermon and the prayer and everything. But sometimes, you know, it's not as quiet as the big prayer hall. So I don't call it like complete segregation. It's a choice.
Okay. Well, I guess the only thing remains is for me to wish you a... Can you say happy Ramadan? Is there a special greeting you say during?
Thank you so much. We say Ramadan Mubarak. So Mubarak, it means like a blessed Ramadan.
High, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I feel so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, so much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran, I feel it inside me, strengthening my iman. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan.
That's it for Local Talk. We've been your hosts for today, Kay Patuk and Ursula Rutenberg.
Today we spoke about Ramadan and also with Daniel Klaas, a teacher of Arabic and social studies at Ames High School, and one of his graduating students, Anya Chamberlain, studying Arabic at Ames High. We also heard from Raed Mahaney, former city councilman and head of the Planning and Zoning Commission, and Salahuddin Saeed and Nurman Sabre, both from the Darul Aqwam Islamic Center, or mosque, here in Ames. Many interviews that Kay did over the last week, and thank you, Kay, for all your work.
Well, you do loads of work, too, Ursula. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends, and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron.
KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you also can find the archives of all of our shows. Please remember that you, as the listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Listening to the show is the most important thing, and your participation as the audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Ramadan Mubarak.
Right.